Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Damon Silvers, Policy Director with the AFL-CIO, who assesses the fallout from the GOP plan to dismantle Medicare and concerns that Democrats will make concessions that would compromise Medicare and Social Security. Ben Schreiber of Friends of the Earth, who talks about the U.S. Senate defeat of legislation to end billions of dollars in federal tax subsidies for big oil, and Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, who discusses the recent return to Honduras of ousted former President Manuel Zelaya amid continuing repression of opposition groups there. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Troops from the Sudanese army have overtaken the disputed region of Abyei, where Khartoum and breakaway South Sudan both have strong ethnic ties, creating fears of a new humanitarian crisis. It comes only weeks before South Sudan plans to become an independent nation and has fueled talk of new fighting. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, who is wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes, has pledged to send his army into other disputed regions, such as the Blue Nile and southern Kordofa, before South Sudan becomes independent. The incursion of the Sudanese army into Abyei has forced up to 150,000 people to flee their homes. Princeton Lyman, the U.S. envoy for Sudan, condemned the military incursion as a very serious violation of the 2005 Compressive Peace Agreement. The interim government of South Sudan, run by the rebel Sudan People's Liberation Army, says it will not retaliate against the incursion of Abyei. Western human rights groups, citing satellite images, say Sudanese army troops are committing war crimes in Abyei, an oil-rich and ethnically divided region. Eliza Griswold of the New American Foundation warned that Khartoum has now begun to employ the same kind of scorched-earth tactics that we saw their forces use in Darfur. Since the Fukushima nuclear crisis took hold in Japan, critics of nuclear power have pointed to the catastrophic risk of earthquakes, tidal waves, and terrorist attacks. But a bigger threat to nuclear power plants may come from more common dangers like fire and eroding safety standards. According to the Center for Public Integrity, a fire breaks out at a U.S. nuclear power plant 10 times a year, and some of these incidents have endangered the plant's nuclear core. In the spring of 2010, the H.B. Robinson nuclear plant in Hartsville, South Carolina, had two fires break out in one day. It led to a seven-hour crisis that left half of the plant without adequate power or a reliable source of cooling water for its nuclear reactor. Despite the seriousness of the incident, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission only issued two minor violations to the operator. There is also growing concern among watchdog groups that the NRC will weaken its fire safety standards to a more industry-friendly formula based on risk of fire. In a review of NRC documents, the Center for Public Integrity found the agency lacked the basic data to create reliable fire safety models for nuclear plants. Upon taking office, President Obama imposed a moratorium on uranium mining near the Grand Canyon, and according to the Christian Science Monitor, this policy is now up for review. The White House can either extend the ban for 20 years or allow mining near the iconic national landmark. Advocates for the uranium mining industry, revived by rising uranium prices, are pushing for an end to the mining ban. They say critics are misinformed about the risk of uranium mining. There are currently over 8,000 mining claims in public lands bordering the Grand Canyon. National environmental groups and water supply managers from Las Vegas to Los Angeles oppose renewed mining as a threat to the integrity of the Colorado River. A draft report by the Federal Bureau of Land Management found renewed uranium mining activity would have little impact on the overall U.S. energy supply. Jane Danowitz of the Pew Environment Group blames the pressure to open up uranium mining near the Grand Canyon on the outdated 1872 mining law, which allows anyone who wants to mine and take minerals from U.S. soil to do it, no matter how much damage it does. There is also concern in Congress over growing foreign ownership of uranium mines. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
When the Republican-controlled House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed Wisconsin GOP Representative Paul Ryan's budget proposal that would have dismantled Medicare and defunded Medicaid, many Inside the Beltway journalists and media pundits praised the legislation as bold, innovative, and courageous. But when the public learned more details about the measure, which would transform Medicare from a program that pays the medical bills of senior citizens over 65 years of age into a voucher system that provides inadequate subsidies to purchase private insurance coverage, public sentiment quickly soured. Republican legislators who voted for the bill were soon confronted by angry constituents who were anxious that the government programs they value and depend on would soon disappear. Public anger also greeted other elements of the GOP-passed budget that would have further reduced the tax burden on the nation's wealthiest citizens and big corporations, even as it made dramatic cuts to many social safety net programs like food stamps without reducing the deficit for 10 years. A special election on May 24th in New York State's 26th congressional district, a longtime GOP stronghold, was viewed by many as a referendum on the Republicans' frontal attack on government entitlement programs like Medicare. When the underdog Democratic Party candidate won in a three-way race, political observers pronounced the Republicans' decision to balance the budget on the backs of grandma and grandpa as a major strategic mistake that may cause the party major losses in the 2012 congressional election. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Damon Silvers, policy director with the AFL-CIO. He discusses the fallout from the GOP budget and concerns that congressional Democrats and the president will negotiate concessions with Republicans that could compromise Medicare and Social Security.
The Republican budget proposes not just reducing the funding to these programs, it proposes fundamentally changing what Medicare is from a program that guarantees to pay for health care regardless of how expensive it gets to essentially a voucher program. It changes it from genuine social insurance into simply a payment, and a payment which the Republicans propose to shrink as the cost of medical care grows, so that over time it would become really an insignificant form of economic security for older Americans. This is obviously a radical program designed to dismantle the key ways, perhaps insufficient ways, but the key ways in which our government helps look after all of us around the things that we desperately need to avoid, you know, lives of hardship in old age, and to do so to benefit the wealthy. And not surprisingly, when voters in New York State, in a special election in a overwhelmingly Republican House district, when voters were asked, are you for this or not, in the context of the fact that the Republican candidate in that district was for the Ryan plan, the Democratic candidate was against the Ryan plan, this overwhelmingly Republican district elected a Democratic candidate.
When you look at the concern expressed by many people about statements made by Democratic House Minority Whip Steny Hoyer, some recent comments by former President Bill Clinton, Vice President Joe Biden, and Barack Obama, telling the country that, yes, Medicare and Medicaid are on the table in budget negotiations. Does that concern you that the Democrats may be gearing up to cave in and pander to the Republicans or meet them halfway at any rate?
The question of what to make of various statements that have been put on the table by different Democratic politicians and ex-politicians, here's what I think is really important. There is a part of the Republican Party that simply doesn't believe that in America we ought to take any responsibility for each other. There's a part of the Republican Party that really believes that our motto as a nation ought to be each of us is completely on our own. And those folks don't like Medicare and Medicaid, never have, haven't liked it since it was created. And they look for any excuse to try to destroy it. There are some Democrats, I'm afraid, who are not prepared to talk about the adequate levels of taxation that are going to be necessary to support this kind of basic social insurance that's necessary for us to be a civilized society. The labor movement is confident that at the end of the day, President Obama is supportive of these basic values that really define what makes modern America a fair society to the extent it is, and that he's going to stand up and defend Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And so far, we think he's done so. But as President Trump has said at this press event, you know, every day is a new day, and we are watching.
As you mentioned a moment ago, Damon, AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka denounced Republicans and their plans to gut Medicare and Medicaid and warned the Democrats that the union movement could withhold support from Democrat incumbents who don't fight aggressively enough to challenge the Republicans' attack on Medicare and Medicaid. What would you like to see the union movement do to step up a challenge to the Republicans in their agenda right now?
Well, what President Trump has talked about at the press club last week, he made those remarks in the context of laying out an ambitious agenda for strengthening the labor movement's capacity both to support politicians that help working people, oppose those that hurt working people, but more importantly, to enact working people's agenda. We do not have in the short term a fiscal crisis. Right, that's a lie. All right. What we have in the short term is a jobs crisis. Right, it's very unfortunate that President Obama has not been clear about this, and that to some extent he has repeated Republican talking points on this matter. But if you go talk to serious economists, there's really not much debate about this. We have 9% unemployment. As a formal matter, we have something like 15, 16% unemployment. In real terms, our economy is weak. Right? It is the worst possible time in which to engage in fiscal austerity. Fiscal austerity will cost us jobs on a large scale. And the people who advocate it think that there'll be long-term beneficial consequences. They don't disagree. In the short term, jobs will be destroyed. This is the worst possible time to do this. However, it is true that we have been running large budget deficits for years, since George Bush became president. And those large budget deficits are about three things. They're about Bush's tax cuts for the wealthy, which have now been extended for 2 years. They're about the fact that somewhere between 10 and 20% of our workforce is not working and not paying taxes. And they're about the fact that we continue to be at war in Afghanistan and Iraq. Those are the reasons why we've been running budget deficits. And unfortunately, the public debate right now is not about fixing really any of those things. And the one we must start with, without which we will not fix anything, is the fact that millions of our fellow citizens who want to work, who want a job, cannot find one today. That for every job opening, there are five people looking for a job. That is what is wrong with our economy today. That is the center of what is wrong up with our economy. And the talk about deficits is nothing but an ideological agenda aimed at turning this country into a dog-eat-dog society for the benefit of the wealthy. It will not fix our economy. It will make it worse.
That was Damon Silvers, Policy Director with the AFL-CIO. Read more about the budget debate and Medicare on our website at btlonline.org. Last month, the U.S. Senate, including three Democrats, defeated a proposal by President Obama that would have eliminated tax breaks from the nation's five largest oil companies, ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, Shell, and ConocoPhillips. Opponents asserted that the loss of federal subsidies would cost jobs. Obama and his allies had urged passage of the legislation, maintaining that while big oil is making record profits and Americans are paying around $4 a gallon at the pump, they shouldn't also be required to support these companies with their tax dollars. The Closing Big Oil Loopholes Act was defeated when all but two GOP senators prevented a floor vote under the Senate's filibuster rules that requires 60 votes to stop. If passed, the bill would have repealed an estimated $21 billion in tax subsidies across 10 years. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Ben Schreiber, climate and energy tax analyst with Friends of the Earth. He describes some of the tax breaks fossil fuel industries have been receiving for decades and explains how renewable energy sources have not caught up. Wind energy, for example, is getting $6 billion in subsidies over 5 years, while tax breaks for solar are inconsistent, not allowing for planning and implementation of more projects.
The president's budget has identified almost $50 billion in tax subsidies for oil and gas companies over the next 5 years. Roughly $4 billion of that is for coal, much less for coal than there is for oil and gas. Oil and gas really get the lion's share. The Menendez bill that was defeated in the Senate actually only went after a small fraction of that money. It only went after tax subsidies to the oil and gas companies, the top five oil and gas companies. So your really massive companies like ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, et cetera. So it only went after the top five, and that would have saved taxpayers slightly over $20 billion over 10 years. So a little bit less than half of what we could have saved in the president's proposal. And the truth is that there's even more money to be had. We could go well beyond the president's proposal and save even more money.
Hydrofracturing or fracking is all the rage now, which is where the companies use mixes of chemicals they don't have to release to the public and enormous amounts of water to access natural gas that's locked into shale rock formations. It's exploding recently because it's a domestic energy source. Do you know what kind of subsidies they get?
So natural gas gets a production tax credit as well. But the biggest danger actually right now with natural gas is that there's a movement to pass a whole host of incentives in something called the Natural Gas Act, which would further incentivize natural gas, including, you know, dangerous practices like fracking, provide them with incentives to move vehicles so that they're powered with natural gas, provide incentives for extracting natural gas. So there's a new proposal to really massively expand the subsidies that are going to natural gas.
Ben Schreiber, what do you know about subsidies for renewables?
So renewables, you know, are being subsidized, and they should be subsidized. The reality is that renewable energy is not a mature technology, and we have not been subsidizing it for almost 100 years in the way that we have for fossil fuels. And so while we do have incentives right now like a production tax credit for wind and an investment tax credit for solar, those are relatively new subsidies for a industry that's really just coming online right now. The other thing that should be noted is that, you know, the quote-unquote renewable subsidy that is the largest is actually for corn ethanol, which is worth about $5 billion a year. But the truth of the matter is that corn ethanol is an environmental disaster. Everything from the incredible amount of pollution that is caused from the fertilizers that are being used on our corn crops, which are then being washed down the Mississippi and creating a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, to the amount of oil that's needed to actually get the fuel to market, all of those things make corn ethanol an environmental catastrophe, and it actually, in many cases, has higher greenhouse gas impacts than conventional oil. There's a production tax credit for wind and other renewables, and what that does is it's a tax credit per kilowatt hours. The other industries like natural gas, like coal gasification, like nuclear reactors, they all also have production tax credits. The thing about the renewables production tax credit, the one for wind, is that that tax credit over its history has expired several times. The investment tax credit is for solar energy, and it's only for solar energy. And so instead of being a per kilowatt hour tax credit, which you can only get once you've actually been in production and are actually creating electricity, this allows you to get a tax write-off for your investment in that technology in advance.
Do you see any likelihood of shifting tax policies to even the playing field between fossil fuels and renewables? Congress seems wed to fossil fuels, even though they're getting harder to produce and by means that are ever more polluting.
We have not seen the last vote on oil and gas subsidies, and we haven't seen the end of this debate at all. There are going to be a series of budget battles that are going to happen over the next year or two, and fossil fuel subsidies are going to be at the center of all of those debates. The next one's going to be the debt ceiling, which is going to happen relatively soon, and there will be a huge fight over the debt ceiling. And one of the things that we should have in the debt ceiling debate, you know, if we're not going to have a clean increase in the debt ceiling, is we should eliminate fossil fuel subsidies and save taxpayers' money by getting rid of those handouts to corporations.
That was Ben Schreiber, climate and energy tax analyst with the Washington, D.C.-based environmental group Friends of the Earth. Learn more about oil company tax subsidies and the work of Friends of the Earth by visiting our website at vtlonline.org. After nearly 2 years of living in exile after the June 28, 2009 coup, which overthrew his government, former Honduran President Manuel Zelaya returned to his nation on May 28. The agreement, which allowed for Zelaya's return, negotiated by the governments of Venezuela, Colombia, and current Honduran President Porfirio Lobo, dropped fraud charges lodged against Zelaya, permitted a future plebiscite on constitutional reform, and cleared the way for the readmission of Honduras to the Organization of American States, which lost its membership after the coup. Speaking to tens of thousands of supporters who met the former president at the capital city's airport in Tegucigalpa, Zelaya called for peaceful, democratic change, saying the problem of poverty, of corruption, will not be solved with violence, but through more democracy, greater citizen participation, and better transparency. Zelaya will now head the National Front for Popular Resistance, a coalition of civil society groups, labor unions, and farmers that challenged a 2009 coup. The populist leader says he wants to model the front in Honduras after the Uruguayan Broad Front, with the goal of winning national elections within 2 years. But while Zelaya's return has given hope to many Hondurans that political reform will soon follow, repression of opposition groups continues. Human rights groups have documented the murders of 8 journalists and dozens of members of the National Front for Popular Resistance, farmers and trade unionists, by paramilitary groups and police. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dana Frank, professor of history at University of California, Santa Cruz. She describes the significance of Zelaya's return to Honduras amid the growing repression.
The deal itself doesn't guarantee anything. It's just between Zelaya and Lobo. Lobo is the current de facto president of Honduras. I want to underscore that Lobo, the current president, was himself came to power in a completely fraudulent election supported by the United States that was controlled by the very same people who ran the military coup, and it was boycotted by both the Honduran opposition and by international observers. So he himself is a very much what we would consider the ongoing coup regime. So when we're talking about these negotiations, who is the legitimate president here is obviously a big question. But it's also really important to understand that this agreement does not in any way address the really terrifying human rights situation in Honduras. And I think most listeners are not aware that the repression of the opposition in the last 3 months is worse than it was after the coup. The Honduran military and police are now using tear gas canisters as lethal force. They've killed at least 2 people that way. They're using live ammunition. And it's been this war against the teachers unions in particular, but against the whole opposition. 5 more people were killed in the last 3 weeks, including 4 campesinos and 2 journalists. This has all been going on completely unreported in the U.S. media. For all the over 300 people that have been killed in the opposition since Lobo himself came to office, and that's not counting another 100 or so in the first end of the original coup president, Roberto Micheletti, no one has been charged for any of those crimes. No one has been prosecuted. No one has gone to jail. You could go out there tomorrow and assassinate a journalist or a teacher or a trade unionist or a campesino, and nothing will happen to you. This pact does nothing to address that really, really terrifying situation. It's really just about Zelaya coming back. Now, Zelaya coming back does mean a huge amount. He's the huge symbol of resistance to the coup, and he represents constitutional order and the rule of law, even for people who are quite critical of him. And he does change the political equation. There were some reports like 1 million people that were in the streets. Even the right-wing pro-coup press reported between 500,000 to 1.5 million people on Saturday at the airport greeting Zelaya.
Dana, tell our listeners a bit about ousted President Zelaya upon his return to Honduras, maintaining that he was going to work hard to make the National Front for Popular Resistance, a coalition of grassroots groups that resisted the coup in Honduras, into an effective electoral coalition that could contest for power in the future, much like that which existed in or was formed in Uruguay in 2005.
Well, this is a $64,000 question on the ground in Honduras. It's really important for listeners to know that through the democratic process of its own decision-making process, the National Front of Popular Resistance had a big assembly in January in which it was agreed that they would not become an electoral party, that they really want to keep building their base as a social movement. And the Frente includes the women's movement, the GLBT movement, the campesina movement, the indigenous movement, the Afro-indigenous peoples, the labor movement, all these widely diverse groups within our sort of fantasy social movement up here, right? Those people have very serious commitment to horizontal politics and to building the base from below. People in the resistance are very wary of becoming a revived liberal party that would be back to the square one of having this very deep patronage politics, because the party in power controls thousands and thousands of jobs immediately and then can parcel them out to its members. And no one wants the Frente in the resistance to just, morph back into a revived liberal party. And there are lots of people, the so-called liberals in resistance, that were party functionaries that are part of the broad umbrella of the resistance and the Frente that have been pushing for over a year now for the Frente to go into electoral politics. So, you know, you're not even getting that reported that they actually voted not to do it in February. Zelaya just forced their hand with all this massive publicity about politics. There's no question that the whole political framework just changed in the last week because of this deal and his return. And I think people are now, like, reeling, because a lot of people like Copin, one of the indigenous groups, and Artists in Resistance, a lot of people have said, wait a minute, we never agreed to this. This is not our pact. The Frente never approved the pact, and we never agreed to go into electoral politics. I think it's quite possible that the train has already left the station, that there's this now steamrolling in place, and people may have to accept that framework. It's going to be very powerful how this plays out in the next month. You know, because, of course, the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton, they very much want a two-party system. They want some kind of revived two-party system. They don't care what its politics are. They just want it to look like there's democracy in Honduras. And remember that the Lobo government, which is controlled by the military, the military controls the state-owned telephone company. They control the airports. They control the immigration service. One of the same generals that ran the coup is in charge of the armed forces. They count the ballots. So what does it mean to go into politics if you can't actually have a free and fair election? The presidential elections are not until 2014, so we're way in advance. But this is what people are going to need to watch while also paying attention to the human rights issue, which is a separate issue, but obviously it's all rolled in together.
That was Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Find links to Frank's recent articles on our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.